Winter Family Weekend just passed, our own kind of winter festival. Mr. Kubik gave the sermon that we all heard last week, and it came through well for us in Atlanta. Last Sabbath, it came from the Winter Family Weekend. He commented that, among other things, we have over 18,000 sermons posted online. That's quite a resource. 18,000, that was more than I might have guessed. Today I wanted to review one of those. It was sent to me by Katie about 2 months ago, and she just said, interesting. It was a sermon originally given by Mr. Peter Eddington in 2014, and his title was, What is the Abomination of Desolation? And I'm going to follow his message closely at times today, but I've also made a number of changes relative to the season we've just passed through. And my title is Christmas, the Abomination of Desolation and the Feast of Dedication. Kind of a long title. Christmas, the Abomination of Desolation and the Feast of Dedication. If you're like me, the first two of these may be more familiar than the last one. We all know about Christmas, and we've got some idea about the Abomination of Desolation, but what is the Feast of Dedication? Have we even heard of it? The quick answer to that question is, it's a human-created festival, meaning by that it's not one of God's commanded holidays. We're all aware that most human-created festivals, holidays, trace back to pagan ceremonies, pagan worship. Just coming through one now, we're all the more familiar with that. How do we answer people who strongly embrace these days like Christmas and see nothing wrong with it, and who even know that it's pagan in its origin? But they say, quote, and I know you've heard this, I do none of those pagan things, and I use it to honor Christ. How might Christ answer this idea about Christmas when he returns? Maybe something like this. I'm just speculating. There's a number of ways you could come back. But suppose Christ would say, you knew that Christmas comes out of pagan origins. That means it comes from the false god, Satan the devil, my and your greatest enemy. And he had humans doing awful things to honor him on that very day. Terrible things, including even sacrificing their own infant children in fires to him. How could it possibly be an honor to me to place my birth and my name on this historically terrible high day of Satan? It's a good question. Can we honor Christ? And you know, you've seen these signs. I saw them this year that as you drive down the road, and here's a picture, and it says Jesus is the reason for the season, but it's not at all the case. And there are other festival days for similar reasons that many embrace and see as harmless, and yet are highly inappropriate when we look at them closely for us to be involved with. Halloween, it's not a hard one. Easter, from Ashtaroth, the pagan queen of heaven and her sun god worship. And again, terrible things associated with that. But are there human-created days that are appropriate or acceptable for us to observe? Most view Thanksgiving that way, and the church supports Thanksgiving as a day set aside to show thanks to God, give thanks to God, and many countries have days similar to our July 4th to celebrate special events in the history of the country, our Independence Day. Here's my question then. Do we see any similar days in the Bible that were not set aside by God as commanded observances, yet were still okay for God's people to keep? Do we see any days like that? And the answer is we actually do. And perhaps surprisingly, there's one that occurs around the time of Christmas that we'll find in the Bible. The modern Jewish continuation of this Israelite-created celebration is called, and now you've heard of it, it's called Hanukkah. Where many people ironically look at, or which they do, and I think we'll see that this is ironic, as a type of Jewish Christmas. And that's not at all what it was. The original name for Hanukkah is the Feast of Dedication. The word Hanukkah means dedication. The intended dedication was actually rededication, being to God. This might again come as a bit of a surprise, but Christ observed this winter festival right at the time of Christmas, the Feast of Dedication. It was spoken of by Christ, and more than that, it has significant end time ties to prophecies that are yet to be fulfilled. So let's see mention of this feast in the Bible. Look in John. Book of John in chapter 10. John 10 and verse 22. Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem. So there we have this feast mentioned. It was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, "How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." And Jesus answered them, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me." And then he continues with instruction and teaching to these Jews. So notice, this feast here was a winter celebration. And we read that Jesus went to the temple where he knew the feast was being celebrated. And we find him teaching the Jews. Where did this feast come from? Where did it start? Why do we find Christ going to the temple for the Feast of Dedication? If we Google this festival, interesting things start appearing right away. Pop up, and I'll admit I really hadn't heard anything about it before I listened to Mr. Eddington's sermon message. Biblically high profile things, prophetically important things, were brought back to 168 BC, the time that God's temple was desecrated during an awful persecution of the Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes, a name that probably ring some bells, Antiochus Epiphanes, and that the first Feast of Dedication was instituted as a celebration in 165 BC. That's 3 years after this Antiochus Epiphanes came in power, when he was removed. Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. The purpose of the new feast was commemoration of the reconsecration of the Jerusalem temple and its altar and sacrifices, restoring it to what it had been after Antiochus had changed it. The feast was instituted by a Jewish priest named Judas Maccabeus. It was a celebration of getting out from under Antiochus Epiphanes, who performed the original abomination of desolation. Apparently, and I think you've all heard of this, by sacrificing a pig on the temple altar to his god Zeus, a Greek god. Some historians will say that it was a statue of Zeus that he set up in that temple, but with the face replaced by that of Antiochus. And I don't know what that is based on, but you can find that idea that he had Zeus in there, but he put his own face on the statue. And to that end, Antiochus the Fourth took on himself the name Epiphanes, which I've been mentioning. This name means God manifest. So that's what he called himself, or the visible God. What does God look like? Well, you're looking at him. I am the visible God. I am God manifest. Can you imagine calling yourself that? Yet that's what this person did in 168 BC that came on the scene and greatly troubled the Jews. Reading more about reasons for the Feast of Dedication, we find that Antiochus was a very powerful force to remove the Jews, to make them abandon their religion, to make them submit to his false religion. And those who would could continue living their lives without persecution. And Mr. Davies just read in Matthew 16 about some who would keep their lives would lose it, and some who would lose their lives would keep it. Those who would go along with Antiochus could continue living their lives without persecution. That's a powerful incentive we have to consider as we go forward. Those who wouldn't would be persecuted and killed by this man. This was almost 2,200 years ago. Why should we pay heed to these events now? And the answer is we must, because Antiochus is coming again. A second Antiochus Epiphanes is coming, who will again attempt to force God's people to abandon their religion. That is our religion. That is God's truth. This is coming again. The Feast of Dedication we read about in John 10, from which eventually derived the present Jewish Hanukkah, commemorates the Jews' victory, the intervention by God over a man and a system that attempted to spiritually terminate them. This is something we will see again, including another very powerful victory from God. So let's read about the time of the first Antiochus and the first abomination of desolation, starting in Daniel 8. Back to the book of Daniel. And here, we're in Amos, so we're close. Hosea, okay. Here we're in the time of the discussion of the prophetic succession of nations that we once in a while review, of world empires. This is when Daniel was in captivity in Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar had his dream of the statue, and Daniel said, "That gold head, that's you, Nebuchadnezzar, that's your empire, and it's going to be followed by another." So this is where we are, the prophetic succession beginning with the Babylonian Empire, and then the Medo-Persian Empire, and then the Greek Empire with Alexander the Great. And in verses 8 through 9 of Daniel 8, within this succession, "Therefore the male goat grew very great," and this male goat is the empire of Alexander. "But when he became strong and Alexander died young, the large horn," this is Alexander, "was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones," and this represents the four governors that took Alexander's kingdom and divided it into four kingdoms, "four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them," so now we're talking about Antiochus here, this is what we're talking about, "out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south," so from the north it's growing toward the south, "and toward the east, toward the glorious land." And I'll leave the detailed prophecy to our literature, but of the four notable ones, Alexander's four generals who divide his empire, one of them became great and encompassed the glorious land, the promised land, to which God's people had returned during the time of the Persian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Second Empire. This included Jerusalem, where the temple existed. This little horn that grew great was based in what is now modern-day Syria and was at the time the king of the north. Historically, it was the Seleucid Empire ruling over the land of Israel, Antiochus IV being the eighth Seleucid ruler over an empire that followed Greek law and Greek philosophies and was determined to Hellenize Israel, to make them as the Greeks, religiously, morally, and otherwise. What was the effect on God's people? Verse 10, And it grew up, this is this little horn, to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. The leadership of this empire, heavily influenced by Satan, set out to persecute, to throw down, to trample God's ways, God's people, God's system, God's plan. And the Seleucid leader then in power, Antiochus Epiphanes, called himself the visible God. Verse 11, he even exalted himself as high as the prince. And notice that's a capital P. This is Christ or God. He exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary, his, capital H, Christ, God's sanctuary, was cast down. This deranged leader of the Northern Empire literally saw himself as God. What did the daily sacrifices represent? The coming Christ. This is what he's throwing out. He took away, removed everything he could that represented the true God, because he wanted no alliances to anything other than the Greek sun god system and himself, who he thought was the head of that system. This was an attack on God's truth and God's plan and on God himself. So in his message, Mr. Edington referred to a book, The History of the Jews by Solomon Grazel, and read from a section in this history textbook about, and this is important, how Antiochus was celebrating not only the birthday of the Greek sun god, Zeus, but his own birthday when he committed the abomination of desolation. That this ruler was born on the 25th of Kislev, which is the ninth month of the Jewish calendar. And this is kind of like the Feast of Tabernacles, how it changes a little bit every year where it falls. And Kislev, this day would usually fall between the very end of November to the end of December. And this abomination of desolation and the birth of their sun god was the 25th of Kislev. So what we find on this day, the 25th, was part of a proto-Christian or pre-Christian festival in honor of the sun god and the visible form of that god himself in his mind, Antiochus. And in doing this, he set up a statue to the sun god in God's temple, and he sacrificed a pig to it. And the Bible refers to this event in history as the abomination that makes desolate. And notice in verse 12, because of transgression, God's people, and you know, you kind of have to look at us as a people now and where we are. And an army was given over to the horn. This is to Antiochus, to that leader, to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this, and he prospered. Antiochus was able to do this and prosper for a time. Verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the certain one, some angelic beings talking, and Daniel listening. He said, how long will this guy be allowed to do this in God's temple? To a certain one speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long is this going to be allowed to go on? And he said to me, this is to Daniel, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed in a feast of dedication to God. That we've gotten rid of this, we're not going to have it anymore. Then it will be cleansed. So here Daniel was given a remarkable prophecy of how long the Jews would be under the persecution of Antiochus. And things like this are part of why you'll see some claims that this book could not be written when the Bible indicates it's written. It actually probably wasn't written by Daniel at all, but by someone much later, because of the detail in these prophecies. Days in this verse, in verse 14, should be translated mornings and evenings. And I see a little one beside days in verse 14 in my Bible. And if I go over to the side, it says literally means evenings and mornings. So the verse is really saying for 2,300 evenings and mornings. And you can see it's easy to call that a day, but an evening and a morning is two units, whereas a day is one unit, and it means 2,300 of those units. You can see in verse 26 the start there, and the vision is of evenings and mornings. And that would be a better rendering, or what's intended by the Hebrew in verse 14. The period of time indicated here by the original Hebrew is 2,300 mornings and evenings, which is 1,150 days, just over 3 years, and fulfilled about December, note that month, 165 B.C. So we've alluded to an end time Antiochus who will appear, the first one being a type of the one still to come. Let's jump forward in this chapter to verse 23. Verse 23, this is still Daniel 8, and in the latter time of their kingdom, and you can see in the end of verse 26 here, therefore seal up the vision, Daniel. It refers to many days in the future. So we've moved to another time here, in the latter time, the end time, when the transgressors have reached their fullness. I've often wondered how far we can sink. And 20, 30 years ago, people would say, I think we've gotten about as poor as we can get. And I'd always say, I'm afraid we can probably get much worse. And we know where we are now. When the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise. This is the next Antiochus, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. This will be a Satan-powered individual. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. Like the first Antiochus, this man is going to be allowed to prosper. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So he will be allowed to persecute some of God's people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And like the first Antiochus, he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince, capital P of princes. He's going to exalt himself as God again, but he shall be broken without human means. God will take him out. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So now let's go to Daniel 11. This chapter again describes Antiochus. We could read the whole chapter and verify that this is the same person as chapter 8. I'll not take time to do that now, but in Daniel 11 and in verse 21, and in his place, so we're talking about succession of leaders. The leader before Antiochus 4 was Seleucus 4. And so we've had a transition here in leadership. In his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So in my New King James, they will not give the honor of royalty is probably not the best wording. Many other versions, and the New Living Translation says he was not in line for royal succession. In other words, he wasn't the one that might have been picked as the leader or expected as the leader, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So people looked at him and said, this guy is really something. I believe he's the one we need in this position, even though he was not in line for royal succession. So the next seven verses after verse 21, there's considerable prophecy about the first Antiochus verified in history. We just read verse 21. Now let's go forward to verse 29, and we're going to read about Antiochus again. And we're in a part of the Bible now where there's considerable duality. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. So this Antiochus shall return at the appointed time. This not like the former or the latter, again, is probably not the best in the New King James. I just went to BibleHub.com. I noticed last week Mr. Kubik said that he likes to go there. And it is a nice place. It gives maybe 30 or so translations and a lot of commentary on those. But I went to BibleHub.com to see how this was translated in other versions. And what I was interested in, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. And I just recorded the first three of the ones that came up. They were all about the same. The NIV said, but it will be different from what it was before at this appointed time. The New Living Translation was the next one, but this time the result will be different. The English Standard Version, but it shall not be this time as it was before. And in verse 30, again, considerable duality in these verses. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, and this is against Antiochus. Therefore, he's not going to be very happy. He's going to be perturbed by this. He shall be grieved and shall return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. The original Antiochus faced resistance from Jews who wouldn't abandon their religion. And his tactic was to show regard for and protect those Jews who would join with him. And we just read here, so he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant, renounce their beliefs. And he'd persecute and kill the others. The word for Cyprus in this verse is the Hebrew kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, which literally means western lands, or in the direction of Cyprus. And again, I've got a little one in my Bible beside that Cyprus in verse 30, and it says Hebrew kittim, western lands, just what I found in commentary there. So this is the first play out, or in its first play out, was the fourth kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar's dream rising the Roman Empire. Ships shall come against him, and therefore he's going to be unhappy. He's going to be grieved. And what did he do? He aroused his own forces, verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then he shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Antiochus IV responded with rage and force to this attempt to remove him. He defiled the sanctuary. He performed his, or the first, abomination of desolation. In Christ Olivet's prophecy, I won't go there, Matthew 24, but if we did, about things to expect when the final type of this Antiochus appears, we are forewarned of, by Christ, occupation of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, something that was going on with the first Antiochus, just like the first. Christ forewarned about persecution of God's people, just like the first Antiochus, if we won't go along. And Christ warned about a second of abomination of desolation, you know the quote, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And yet he's talking about the end time. And that's Matthew 24:15. I'll go there in a little bit, but not right now. Like Antiochus the IV, we are to anticipate a future ruler who views himself as God, who will perform some kind of blasphemous act in God's temple shortly before Christ returns. How will this leader attempt to win over God's people? We need to be aware. Daniel 11, verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. Against the covenant. And we can go back to the end of verse 30 again. So he shall regard and show, or return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. This has to be God's people, the ones who at one time were keeping it. Wickedly against the covenant. In verse 32, these were Jews for the first Antiochus. For the last Antiochus, these are church members who decide to align themselves with this ruler. And this is the beast power of Revelation, that coming power to go along with what he's doing. what he requires religiously, and he will corrupt them, verse 32, with flattery. You guys are so bright. You see the big picture. This is something that needs to be done, and you can see that. You're something. Flattery. Will some hold true? Verse 32, the second half. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword, and flame by captivity and plundering. So there will be persecution on those who understand, those who know God. Verse 34, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them with intrigue. This again is a translation that's probably a little hard to follow the intent. They shall be aided with a little help. Other translations, I've forgotten which one this is I pulled, but this is more typical. During these persecutions, little help will arrive. They shall be aided by a little help. Little help shall arrive, and many who are with them will not even be sincere, is another translation for verse 34, and I think more in line with what is being said here. Verse 35, and some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Then the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt. So this guy's going to do it too. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, and speak blasphemy against the God of gods, and prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. So he's going to prosper until he's done what is assigned to him, basically what he's allowed to do. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. Okay, we talked about resistance against the first Antiochus. This is Antiochus 4, from the family of Jewish priests called the Maccabees, who established the Feast of Dedication. These Jews ultimately, finally, after 3 years of suffering oppression from Antiochus, overthrew an Antiochus who was weakened by the Roman Empire, and they cleansed God's temple. This occurred during the time of pagan winter celebrations. And we talked about how the Maccabees initiated a new celebration as part of this cleansing, a feast of dedication to God. This feast of dedication began on the 25th day. We're saying 25th day a lot, aren't we? The 25th day of the ninth month, this is Kislev, the same day Antiochus had 3 years earlier desecrated the temple, and it was an 8-day festival established with the removal of Antiochus. Here's the ironic part of this again. The winter feast and pagan ceremonies of Antiochus and his defiling of the temple were the same winter solstice and sun worship ones that ultimately evolved into modern Christmas. And yet people have come to look at the Jewish Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication, as a Jewish Christmas. But the reality is, in its origin, this Feast of Dedication was a celebration to replace the solstice sun god worship. In Mr. Edington's sermon, he used these words: this feast is a rebuttal of the winter solstice and those festivals which became, quite honestly, Christmas today, including trying to force God's people, the Jews, to get involved with the orgies and everything else that was part of that observance. Mr. Edington, in his message, then went to a pair of history books called First and Second Maccabees. Do those ring any bells? Anybody? First and Second Maccabees. If you happen to have any of these big old Bibles around your house, this is one I found in my great uncle's attic after he died, and I asked anybody want it, and no one did, so I took it. Some of these have a section in them called the Apocrypha, right? And Maccabees is part of that. So We don't look at that as part of the canon, as canonical or inspired, but rather as history, the Apocrypha. And Mr. Eddington read some of that history. I think I put a marker, yep, it's still there, in Maccabees. And when I turn to Maccabees here, the first Maccabees, and this, look how yellow this thing is, yellow from age. It's 1875, 141 years old. The introduction to the first book of Maccabees is, Antiochus gave leave to set up the fashions, or the ways, of the Gentiles in Jerusalem, and he spoiled it and the temple in it, and set up therein the abomination of desolation, and slew those that did not circumcise, and slew those that did circumcise their children, in other words, the Jews. So here we have Antiochus even mentioned by name in Maccabees, this ruler, this first Antiochus. And Mr. Eddington said, I'm going to read verses 57 through 67 of chapter 1. So let's go ahead and do that. And rather than carry that thing, I typed it in here. From Maccabees, King Antiochus set up the abominable idol of desolation upon the altar of God, and they built altars around all the cities of Judah throughout, and they burned incense and sacrificed at the doors of the houses in the streets. They cut in pieces and burned with fire the books of the law of God. So remember, this guy is coming back, unfortunately. And everyone with whom the books of the testament of the Lord were found, whosoever observed the law of God, they put to death according to the edict of the king. Thus, by their power, did they deal with the people of Israel that were found in the cities month after month. And on the 25th day of the month, they sacrificed upon the altar of the idol, over against the altar of God. Now the women that circumcised their children were slain according to the commandment of King Antiochus. They hung the children by their necks. And this isn't referring to the children being hung by their necks, but rather the children were hung around the necks of their mothers. They hung the children around the necks of the mothers in all their houses, and those who had circumcised them were then put to death. Now many of the people of Israel determined with themselves, consistent with Mr. Davies' message, that they would not eat unclean things, and they chose rather to die than be defiled with unclean meats. They would not break the holy law of God. They were put to death, and there was great wrath upon the people. So this is an account of God's people being killed because they would not forsake the truth. They literally did love God more than their own lives. We saw in Daniel 11, 33 and verse 35, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Verse 35, and some of those of understanding shall fall. The reference to God's people who understand. The Old Testament Jews had very limited understanding of God's plan. The coming sacrifice of Christ, the opportunities of the various resurrections, they didn't understand these things. This is a New Testament church reference here. Those who understand, an end time reference to people who understood God's plan and can teach it. Notice verse 35. And some of those who of understanding shall fall. And why is this? Why will this occur? To refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Some of those with understanding shall fall to refine them, to make them ready. In God's church, it seems to suggest that some in the church of God will be interested in, intrigued by the message, but will really not be all that excited, won't be ready to go when this final time of trouble comes, and will, quote, be refined in it. It will be much better if we can refine ourselves now, rather than have it happen in the tribulation, which is what we're referring to. We find something perhaps similar in Revelation 12. Let's go look in Revelation 12 about a time of refining. Revelation 12, for part of the church, not all of the church, Revelation 12 and verse 13. Now when the dragon, Satan, saw that he had been cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman. This is the church. This is what's sitting here today, who gave birth to the male child, capital Christ. But the woman, and this is the place of safety, the protection promised by God, was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for 3.5 years. And we've talked about that before. And Satan didn't like that. He didn't want that to happen. Verse 15, Satan spewed waters out of his mouth like a flood. And we know this can represent armies. After the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by these armies. But the earth, God said, no, Satan, you can't have these people. The earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So we know that God promises protection for the church. But then there's another group in verse 17 that's much like what we just read about in Daniel 11:35. And the dragon was enraged with the woman because he couldn't get a hold of her, the part he was after there. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. There will be a lot of people who come out of the tribulation. A lot of people probably are referred to here who will keep the commandments of God, who will say, it was correct. I should have been more with the program. Again, it would be better to refine now than to have to do that during the tribulation. Regarding protection, regarding safety, God does tell us that we should pray. We should ask for this, to be found worthy to escape all these things. We really need to be doing this. Let's go to Matthew 24 now, to this Olivet prophecy. Matthew 24, start in verse 3 in that chapter. Matthew 24, 3. And you know this well. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? So we've moved to the end of the age. And then Christ went through a number of things that they should watch for. And in verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world as a witness. And then the end will come. Verse 15, and remember, we're talking about the time of the end now. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, when you see it again, whoever reads, let him understand. You guys have heard of this before. It's happened before. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Those of God's people who have decided they won't abandon the truth, won't join this false system, will need to flee for their lives. Verse 17, let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of the house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. We already read about the awful things done to God's people by the first Antiochus, including women and infants who were attacked and killed. And Christ here says, woe to those who are pregnant and have infants. Verse 20, and pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. And I always said, fleeing in the winter can be dangerous. But there's really more to that here than I think I picked up on. There's coming a time, it's indicated, when it will be too dangerous, and the church's only recourse will be to flee. Christ is saying in this prophecy that when this time is reached, that's what we'll need to do. This is a direct parallel to when the first Antiochus performed his abomination, and we just read about that in verse 15, for the future, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And Christ says, flee, get out of the city, don't even take time to grab some extra clothes, or you'll be caught and killed. And for the place of safety, I don't know how it'll happen. I always kind of pictured an angel or two showing up and just saying, it's time to go. Come on, it's time to go. What season, again, did the first Antiochus desecrate the temple as part of pagan worship? It was in the winter. Apparently as part of a winter solstice pre-Christmas festival. And we've seen what the devout Jews who overthrew him replaced his winter festival with, the Feast of Dedication, which Christ attended in the winter. It's kind of interesting that those specific words were added in John 10, that this was in the winter. And here in Matthew 24:20, perhaps looking back at the first Antiochus and the season of the year when he killed God's people, including women and children, and did this, why do we stay away from Christmas? What is it about the roots that we don't like and that God doesn't like? Why is it impossible to honor God on this day? Well, here we find Christ saying, pray that it's not in the same season of the year as the forerunner was. We do need to pray for God's protection and for the place of safety and a final training of God's people. And we can take great comfort in knowing that God's church will prevail, that God can see us through the final time of trouble. Back to Maccabees, 1 Maccabees 4, 52-56, and I'm reading this again as history, not as scripture. This was after Antiochus was removed. They, it's referring to the devout Jews, arose before the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, and that's Kislev then, and they offered sacrifices according to the law upon the new altar, which they had made according to the time and according to the day wherein the heathens had defiled it. So they put the Feast of Dedication right on top of, to cover, to erase, to get rid of the pagan winter solstice feast. Unfortunately, it came back. It didn't stay there. And the same day was dedicated anew with canticles and harps and lutes and cymbals, and all the people fell on their faces and adored and blessed up to heaven him who had prospered them. And they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days, and they offered with joy and sacrifices of salvation and praise. There's a similar future day coming for God's people. God had freed them from persecution. They were filled with joy, and they established a feast of joy and rededication. 1 Maccabees 4:59, and Judas, who is now known as Judas Maccabee, and Judas and his brothers and all the church of Israel decreed that the day of the dedication of the altar should be kept in a season from year to year for 8 days. This 8 days was probably taken from the Feast of Tabernacles in the last great day. From the 5th and 20th, the 25th day of the month of Kislev, with joy and gladness. In the time of Christ, the Jews remembered their deliverance from Antiochus. It had only been about 170 or so years earlier. They weren't terribly long removed from that and observed the Feast of Dedication. And we saw that Christ himself traveled to the temple during the Feast of Dedication and taught there. It's not a commanded festival, but was a festival of joy and thanksgiving that Christ thought appropriate to observe. What are the lessons for us then in the Feast of Dedication? First, Christmas, which we've just survived again, and I know for some of you with very real challenges, has a terrible history, including of awful persecution of those who would not turn their backs on God. Second, there is coming a very evil end-time ruler. Revelation refers to him and his government as the beast, the final Antiochus. But we'll recognize him and we'll understand what's happening, as I think we do now as we see Satan demolishing the family and all threads of God's truth outside of the small true church. And finally, there will be a great feast of joy, thanksgiving and dedication to our great God after he conquers and removes this final Antiochus and Satan and all evil. It begins with the approaching millennial rule of Christ, and then we'll go forward for all eternity as the joyous kingdom of God. So I hope we've seen today some interesting ties between Christmas, the abomination of desolation, and the ancient Jewish Feast of Dedication.